Welcome to the Binder Family Speaker Series, a podcast dedicated to high-level research on contemporary anti-Semitism by fostering productive and collegial discussion of the most pertinent issues before us. Hosted by the Indiana University Institute for the Study of Contemporary Anti-Semitism. For more information about this speaker series, ISCA news, or videos of past webinars, please visit our website at isca.indiana.edu. And now to present our speaker, Dr. Alvin H. Rosenfeld.
Ronnie, welcome. I know you're in Jerusalem. Gunther is in Bloomington. I'm at the moment in the town where you lived once upon a time and went to college, Georgetown. Good to see you. We last saw one another in Jerusalem. Before that, we had the pleasure of having you in Bloomington, and we look forward to continuing a really very interesting, cordial, and productive relationship with you. Meron Mazzini was born in Jerusalem in the pre-state period. He did his academic studies in America at CCNY in New York City, at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., and at Harvard, where he took his PhD in Asian studies, a subject that continues to interest him to this day. For a period of around about 16 years or so, he served as director of Israel's press office. He was directly responsible for that office under Premier Levi Eshkol, Golda Meir, and Yitzhak Rabin. In an earlier conversation we had with him today, I learned he also knew David Ben-Gurion, so he dates back to the very earliest times in Israel's history. He's kept himself busy over many years in public policy, in academic life. He's taught at both the Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University, lectured very widely in Israel, America, and parts of Asia. To his credit, he somehow has managed to keep writing, and he's the author of some 9 books, including a prize-winning book on Golda Meir, which I strongly recommend because it is now in English translation. And shortly before we went on the air today, he informed me that a new book he's done on Japan will be forthcoming. So hats off to you, Ronnie, for all you've done and continue to do. It's now my pleasure to turn over to you.
Thank you very much, Alvin. Nice to be with you all, wherever you are. And it's good evening from Jerusalem. The thesis I wish to present before you in one sentence is this: anti-Semitism played a very important role in the decision of many countries, probably the majority of the countries that voted for partition in the General Assembly session of November 1947. That gave Israel sort of a birth certificate. And I'll explain all this in a moment. I want to go to start off the discussion in 1945. April 1945, the first session of the United Nations, newly created, took place in San Francisco. The Jewish Agency sent a delegation. The main purpose of the Zionist intent was to ensure that Palestine remains a British mandate, because the United Nations saw itself as the heir of the League of Nations. The League of Nations gave Britain the mandate over Palestine. We wanted to be sure that the mandate continues under the British. This is April 1945. The war is not over yet. And the fear was that at some point there will be other claims on Palestine, and therefore we wanted to ensure that Britain remains. Another reason for this idea was the Labour Party was running what would become the elections of July 1945. The Labour Party platform was very supportive of a Jewish state, the idea of partition. At some point, they even mentioned the possibility of transfer of Arabs to Iraq, away from a future, possible future Jewish state. And therefore, the Jewish community here, the Zionist movement, the Jewish agency, had an enormous stake in a victory of the Labour Party in England, which took place in the summer of July 26, 1945. Around the same time, President Truman sent to Europe Earl Harrison, who was the dean of the law school of the University of Pennsylvania, to determine what to do with displaced persons. And he traveled to Germany, where there was by now hundreds of thousands of Holocaust survivors. His recommendation was pressure Britain to allow 100,000 Jews to enter Palestine. The British policy at the time was the result of the 1939 White Paper, which basically banned Jewish immigration to Palestine and the sale of land from Arabs and others to Jews. In other words, dooming the Jewish community to remain in tiny minority. At the time, 1945, we were about less than 600,000 Jews in this country. One reason for the American thinking at the time was there is enormous pressure to bring Jews to America. Let's see if we can ask the British to open up Palestine, and at least 100,000 Jews would go to Palestine, and therefore they will not come to America. Ben-Gurion visited the camps in October 1945, met with Eisenhower, and he came back, and his impression was, if America would open up its gates, the majority of Holocaust survivors in Europe would go to America, not to Palestine. And probably he was right. But America stuck, adhered to its 1924 immigration policy. I think it's called the Johnson-Reed Act, and American gates were closed. In 1945, many Holocaust survivors faced a major dilemma. Do we go back to where we came from? Do we remain in DP camps? Or do we try to go elsewhere? The majority of the world was closed to Jews, as it has been in the 20s and mostly in the 30s and during the war. In 1946, by the way, the Labour won, and Labour decided to continue the policy of the mandate, namely ban immigration, no sale of land. The British policy also called for an Anglo-American Commission of Inquiry. They said to the Americans, you are pushing 400,000 Jews to come to Palestine rather than to go to New York or elsewhere. Share the burden with us and we'll gain time. You will see what's involved. And we had an Anglo-American Commission of Inquiry, which came here in the winter of 1946. The results of the commission were very simple. They said, we support the idea of 100,000 Jews, and we want to continue the mandate. The British government and very wisely said to the Jews, 100,000, fine with us, provided you disarm. And therefore, we had no intention of disarming, because that would have faced us directly with the threat of local Arabs and neighboring Arab countries. And therefore, nothing much came out of it. Then the Americans and the British proposed another idea, cantonization of the country. The Jews organized a united resistance movement, which meant basically going at the terrorist attacks on British installations carried out by the Haganah, the largest underground organization, Irgun, Etzel, the Begin's group, and the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel, which was the smallest group, known derisively as the Stern Gang. The British realized that they were facing a major problem in terms of attacks on airfields, railway stations, railways, bridges, and whatnot. And therefore, they decided to clamp down, arrested some of the leaders, Charette and a few others. Ben-Gurion was in Paris at the time. They decided not to arrest Golda Meir. The Jewish response partly was to blow up the southern wing of the King David Hotel, resulting with the loss of considerable loss of life, 91 people. The operation was carried out by the Irgun, but with the full knowledge of the Haganah. At some point, the Haganah asked them to postpone. Begin said, I'll do it in the afternoon. Ended up doing it 12 noon, but giving a warning. The King David Hotel changed a great deal of the situation and created, for example, enormous anti-Semitism in Britain. There were huge losses of life, but it also drove more and more British leaders, Labour Party leaders, to ask, what's the point of hanging on to Palestine? Why are we there? Jews don't want us, the Arabs don't want us. It's costing a fortune. It's straining our relations with America. We're losing people. I could well understand years later, I was 50 years old, I served as a reserve officer in Lebanon, when Israel was in Lebanon. And we faced the same dilemma at some point in Lebanon. Well, what are we doing here? Costing a fortune, we're losing people. What's the purpose of the whole thing? The King David Hotel probably tilted the scales in favor of the British deciding somehow to divest themselves, to disengage from Palestine. The Americans asked the Zionist leadership a very simple question. What do you want? You can't have a Jewish state in the entire country. You don't want an Arab state in the entire country. You don't want partition. You don't want cantonization. You don't want federal arrangement. You don't want continuation of British mandate. What do you want? And this was the subject of a discussion held in Paris in the first week of August 1946. Present were Bahilo Silver, Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, some other leaders. And the decision was to inform the American government that the Zionist organization, Jewish agency, would be agreeable, amenable to a Jewish state in Palestine, in a viable part of the country. In other words, the concept of partition was accepted by the Jews. The Arabs rejected any idea. But now the Jews had given the Americans something. Nahum Goldman, who was one of the negotiators, went back to Washington His contact was Dean Acheson, number two in the State Department, and said to him, this is what we would like to have. Acheson basically said, fine, at least we have something we can work on. Truman accepted the recommendation and he issued a statement timed for Yom Kippur 1946, in which he supported America and is now going to support the partition of Palestine. It was sort of lukewarm, tepid, but it was important for him because it was read in synagogues in America, Yom Kippur, and it helped the Democrats in the midterm elections of November 1946. They didn't win the House, but at least it helped in some places. For the rest of 1946, there was not much action. Things begin to change in February 1947, when the British government finally decided we want out. For years, there has been an argument in this country and other places, who kicked the British out? The Irgun said we did, the Haganah said we did. The truth is the British kicked themselves out because they realized that there was nothing for them. No good will come out of their staying in Palestine at the time under the circumstances. And therefore, what they did was asked the United Nations to deal with the issue. You are the heir, the successor of League of Nations. The League of Nations gave us the mandate. We are now coming to you. Tell us what to do. Future, the issue is known as future government of Palestine. In early March 1947, one of the heads of the Jewish Agency Political Department wrote a memorandum basically saying, we're now going to face a United Nations. We have no experience with the United Nations. There were at the time, I think about 52 or 53 countries. In the summer, two more would join, India and Pakistan. And he said, what do we know about Liberia? What do we know about Thailand? What do we know about China, Philippines? We know a great deal about Eastern Europe, we know a great deal about Western Europe, America. We don't know much about Latin America. And therefore he suggested that areas of responsibility be assigned. The London office should look after Scandinavia and the Western European countries. The Washington office should look after Latin America. The Paris office should look after other countries. And when they started mapping out the world to see who knows whom and who can do what. Parallel to that, incidentally, the Jewish Agency Political Department established a course for diplomats. I remember that well because my father taught a class in that course, Zionist diplomacy. And most of the 28 participants in that course eventually became the core of the future foreign ministry of Israel. The UN decided to select a commission of inquiry called UNSCOP, United Nations Special Commission of Palestine. None of the great powers were represented. The chairman was a Supreme Court judge from Sweden, Justice Sandström. They came here in June and they were here for 6 weeks. The Arabs boycotted this committee. The Jews, of course, were represented. And they held hearings in the YMCA in Jerusalem. I was present there because I was a messenger boy for my father. He attended as a reporter, and I used to take messages, notes from him to the Jerusalem office of Haaretz on my bicycle. In fact, I think I was paid £3, which was a lot of money at the time. The Commission of Inquiry proposed two possibilities: partition or a federal arrangement. 7 voted for partition, 3 for a federal arrangement, 1 abstained, I think the Australians. Now the issue comes before the United Nations General Assembly, second session in New York. The world, the UN, is divided into a number of blocks. And Jewish Zionist delegation, the Jewish Agency delegation, began to assign countries to specific people. Abba Iban, for example, was assigned Iceland, Luxembourg, I think Holland and Belgium. Wrote about in his memoirs. Others were assigned other countries. The diplomacy still was shtetl diplomacy, called in Hebrew, it's called shtadlanut. Who knows whom? Who can influence whom? But soon it became obvious that there would be many other considerations that would influence the policies and the decision of a given country to support partition or to oppose partition. So let's look at the blocks. The first were the Arab states, the Muslim Arab states. It was obvious that they would oppose any solution apart from an Arab state in Palestine, with the Jewish minority tolerated, protected minority, which was the Islamic tradition. We're talking about Egypt and Syria and Lebanon and Iraq and Saudi Arabia. Add to that Iran and then newly elected India, Pakistan. There's not much you can do. The Soviet Union supported partition already in the discussion in April and May 1947. Not with a great deal of excitement, but they said, if this doesn't work, then we will support partition. Soviet Union meant Russia, Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, and at the time also Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. And therefore the assumption was that they will support partition, and you don't have to worry too much about their vote. Why did some of the Eastern European countries support partition? Here I bring in anti-Semitism. Tens of thousands, maybe even more, of Holocaust survivors began to go home to the countries where they came from. By and large, they were greeted with enormous amount of hostility by the non-Jewish population. Basically said to them, the Nazis didn't finish you off. But the Jews came, and it was assumed, and rightly so, that they would demand back their apartments and businesses and shops and communal properties, synagogues, community centers, yeshivot, chadarim, whatnot. And this is basically what happened, not only in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe. In some places, Jews are still arguing over paintings, artworks looted by the Nazis, and they want them back to this very day, 80 years later. The anti Jewish sentiments, especially in Poland, culminated with a pogrom, in a Polish city called Kielce in July 4th, 1946. And resulted in the killing of 40, 41 Jews. This was the sign of the Haganah, to organize what became known as the Bricha, the flight. Starting to move Jews from Poland, Romania, Hungary, parts of Czechoslovakia, to the American zone of occupation in Germany. Now these people would become an American problem. America would have to address the issue that we are now responsible for over 300,000 Holocaust survivors who lived in DP camps in Germany. I'm not aware of any American leader, president, secretary of state, others, who at any point said, let's take them to America. And therefore, I argue that one of the reasons for the support given to partition in America and other countries was, we'll give them a state. Hopefully the Jews in Europe will go there. Maybe Jews living in other countries will also go there. And we'll get rid of anti-Semitism. Many Israelis were reminded of the conference organized in Evian in the summer of 1938 by President Roosevelt to deal with the issue of Jewish refugees from Germany. The British agreed to attend, provided Palestine was not discussed. And the representative of the Histadrut, of the Federation of Labor in Jewish Federation of Labor in Palestine, was Golda Meir. And she recalled all sorts of countries rose and said, we don't have space. Brazil, they don't have space. And this will create anti-Semitism, and we can't handle this. One country did accept Jews, and that was the Dominican Republic, out of all places. But the rest of the world closed its gates completely to the Jews. And here you had the same problem. Countries did not want Jews. Canada didn't want Jews. America didn't want Jews. Australia didn't want Jews. New Zealand didn't want Jews. South Africa didn't want Jews. It would be easier if we will give them a state of their own. And this also will hopefully bring about massive emigration of Jews from our countries to the newly established Jewish state. I cannot in any way document this in writing. Now, I've tried to do it. No one in authority ever said so. Let's get rid of our Jews, give them a state, they'll go there. I couldn't find anything to really base my claim on documentation. Another bloc was British Commonwealth. Britain immediately announced that we will not oppose partition, we will not support partition, we'll abstain. However, we are not going to implement any partition plan. And in September, they announced we are out by August 15th. As long as we are there, we are responsible for law and order. Once we leave the country, that's it. The other members of the Commonwealth can do whatever they want. And in fact, all of them supported partition. Next block was Western Europe. Here you had a combination of anti-Semitism, many of these countries had a tradition of anti-Semitism, and more recently, guilt feelings over the role many of them played in during the Holocaust. Who turned over tens of thousands of French Jews to the Germans? French. Who turned Dutch Jews, including Anne Frank, to the Nazis? Dutch. And now we know much more about all this. And therefore, there was guilt feeling, but there was also anti-Semitism. They didn't want the Jews to come back and claim property and so on. So we'll support partition, there'll be a Jewish state, let them go there. This accounted probably for the votes in France, in Holland, and Belgium. You had five Scandinavian countries, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Iceland. Denmark, probably the only country that actively rescued Jews during the war by moving 5,000-6,000 of them to Sweden over one night. The key bloc was the Latin American blocs, over 20 countries. And there you had an interesting situation. You had first and foremost a great deal of influence of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church opposed Zionism from the days of Herzl. But he met a pope, I think it was Leo IX, forget the name, and the Pope said to him, the last thing we're going to support is a homeland for the Jews in Palestine, God forbid. However, the church was able to insist at least on the internationalization of Jerusalem. And this became part of the partition proposal. Jewish state, Arab state, internationalized Jerusalem, end of mandate. And therefore, the Jewish leadership had to accept essentially the fact that Jerusalem was not going to be included in the Jewish state. It's a huge concession at the time, but the idea was that if we want a Jewish state, we'll have to forgo Jerusalem. And since the church had enormous influence in virtually all of Latin American countries, and they consisted of the largest bloc, we'll have to swallow the pill. Latin America, there was another issue. Virtually no Latin American country had an interest in the Middle East. Oil, Suez Canal, nationals, and so on. There were, in Western Europe, there were a number of countries that had a great deal of involvement in the Middle East. For example, France. France had a great deal of investments in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Syria. Quite a few French nationals living at the time. Another country, by the way, that eventually, I think the Arabs either abstained or voted against was Greece. Quite a few Greeks living in Egypt at the time. Therefore, they had to take into account this fact. The Latin American bloc had another problem. They opened their gates to a number of Nazi war criminals, chief among them Eichmann, who fled to Argentina. The Jewish communities did not have a major political power in any of these countries. They were small. not that wealthy. And I'm not sure if the Jewish influence played a role, as it did, for example, in the United States. So you have here a combination of innate anti-Semitism, massive influence of the church, Roman Catholic Church. And the idea was, let the Jews get their state. Maybe some of our local Jews will disappear from here and immigrate to that country. The key, of course, was the United States. And here you had an amazing situation. The president determined partition is the solution. Secretary of State was opposed. Secretary of Defense was opposed. Pentagon was opposed. CIA was opposed. The UN delegation of the United States took orders from the Department of State. But you had here conflicting views. The president acted for a variety of views. He's a decent man, he knew his Bible, his issue of morality, Holocaust. But there was also political consideration, elections, and Jewish votes in key states. And therefore, he instructed on a number of occasions, he called the delegation directly. One instance was a meeting organized with Weizmann, Chaim Weizmann, who actually had no official position, but he was the veteran Jewish leader. He met Truman in September 1947 and persuaded Truman to add the Negev, the southern part of Israel, to the Jewish state. The original partition plan excluded the Negev. And the story goes that Truman picked up the phone to a member of the American delegation to the UN, General Hildering. Hildering, the Negev to the Jews. By the way, this was first meeting of Weizmann and Truman, organized by a door opener called David Niles. And therefore, you had here already a conflict in the American, among the American delegation. What do we do? Who do we take orders from? It was obvious that the man who determines policy would be the president. I'm not going to go into China and other places. The Department of State realized that Truman wanted partition to succeed. There's another reason why he wanted partition to succeed. This was the first test case for the UN. And at the time, 1947, they wanted the UN to succeed. And if the UN can resolve a major crisis, good for the UN, more power to the UN. The Russians were very much aware of Cold War considerations. Get the British out. They assumed the Jews would win, and at some point the Arabs would come to them for arms. Basically what happened 7-8 years later. Russians left Egypt only after the Yom Kippur. So here you had a conflicting situation. Very few leaders ever said the Jews can capable of changing the region, and they can teach the Arabs and modernize the Middle East and do all these nice things that we're doing right now. The end result was, of course, the partition resolution. 33 in favor, 13 against, 10 abstention, 1 absent, Thailand. There was a revolution in Thailand, the ambassador decided to go home, therefore they were not there. I want to refer to what Professor Mead said several weeks ago, and I will hold the discussion there. It already after partition, the leadership of the Department of State, headed by George Kennan, who was chief of policy planning, and the Middle East section, supported by basically the Secretary of State, George Marshall, came to a conclusion partition is unworkable. We've got to rethink and eventually go back to the General Assembly and ask them to postpone and to put the country under trusteeship. Because already there was civil war in Palestine, so it was deemed very important for Truman to meet Weizmann. Truman refused. Truman knew that the State Department was looking at partition. He did not know when they were going to introduce it. The door opener was Eddie Jacobson, and Professor Mead discussed this at great length. Weizmann met Truman on condition that it would not be announced and there would be no one else present, no note taker, and that Weizmann would come through a side door. And therefore, we don't know what happened there. Truman didn't mention this and Weizmann didn't mention this. The assumption is that Truman said to Weizmann, I'm still supporting partition. 2 days later, the American delegation to the UN asks for a special session of General Assembly to reconsider partition and go for trusteeship. And Truman read this in the New York Times and he was furious. He said, I promised Weizmann that everything is all right. And here he'll think I'm a liar or I have no control over my State Department. But he knew about this all along. He just didn't know when they were going to do it. Probably at the time he sent word to Weizmann through Judge Samuel Rosenman, who was very close to him, if Israel, if the Jews proclaim independence, we will recognize them. And this may be the reason why 2 days before partition, before the British mandate ended, and it was not yet sure what's going to happen, Weizmann in his hotel room in Waldorf Astoria in New York was pacing and muttering in Yiddish, was bauten them idiot, why are these idiots waiting for? Because he knew if and when there would be a recognition. So all in all, I would suggest to you that anti-Semitism, the idea of getting rid of Jews, was part of the reason for the support of these 33 countries that voted for the partition of Palestine, which basically eventually led 6 months later to a proclamation of independence. And we're going to celebrate 75 years in 3 days' time. I stop right here and I invite your comments and questions.